It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Like so many others from Europe and the United Kingdom, people from Denmark joined the wave of migration to America in the 19th century. They came here looking for land to farm and opportunities, and many of them came to Iowa. This hour, we'll explore Danish-American culture and Danish-Iowan culture. Tove Brandt, curator of Danish-American culture at the Danish-American Museum in Elkhorn, is here today. She's taking a break in the midst of preparing for Yule Fest and a new exhibit to talk with us today. Tove, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Charity.
And Yule Fest is coming up Friday and Saturday at the Danish-American Museum in Elkhorn, which is your big holiday celebration, right?
That's right. And it's not just the museum. It's the entire community of Elkhorn and Kimbolton. This is our town-wide festival for the holiday season.
All right. Very exciting. And I want to talk about the Danish immigration story because it is a little different from some of the other groups that came to the United States and came to Iowa during this same period. We know a lot of Germans came to Iowa, a lot of Norwegians came to Iowa. What made the Danes a little bit different?
Well, part of it is just the sheer number and timing of the Danish immigration. Denmark is a small country today, and it was a small country then. But even compared to countries of a similar size, there are fewer Danish immigrants that arrive in the United States in the 19th century and the early 20th century. In round numbers, we're talking about 300,000 Danish immigrants. But that compares to about 800,000 Norwegians, about 1.2 million Swedes, and about 6 million Germans in that same time period. So you're talking about a smaller group. That's still a lot of people, but it's a smaller group, and they actually start arriving a little later than some of those other European immigrant groups. They start arriving in large numbers in the 1850s and 60s. And most of them are motivated by the same types of drives, you know, of a lack of opportunity at home, especially in agricultural communities where a farm can only be split among so many children, or maybe it will only be inherited by the oldest son. And so that leaves all other siblings kind of forced to figure out how to make a living. And will that be at home in Denmark or moving to a Danish city like Copenhagen? Or will it be striking out, you know, to the new opportunities of the United States? That's part that is very similar throughout a lot of Northern European immigration. What makes it a little different is that timing. By the time that Danes started coming to the United States, it was actually a lot easier to come by yourself. Steamships were traveling much more reliably across the Atlantic Ocean. Railroads were more developed, and so you could actually buy a ticket in Denmark to come all the way to Chicago or Racine, Wisconsin or Omaha, and you didn't need the support and protection of a family group or community group to travel with you. So you see a lot of young adults traveling and making their way in this new land.
Well, and a lot of the other settlers who came earlier, they'd form communities. And once they got to a place and started a little town, let's say a town made up mostly of German settlers, then they would send word back home and say, hey, we found a good spot. Come on over. So did that not happen as often with the Danes?
It happened maybe not quite as often. It certainly did happen. We see that in the heritage of towns like Elkhorn and Kimbolton in Iowa, Ringsted, Iowa, and other communities. But because of those kind of subtleties of demographics, the age of immigrants and whether they're traveling as single, unmarried young people or as family groups, you see Danish immigrants a little more likely to go to a city and to just kind of fit in with the mainstream city culture. And so the places where you get a critical mass of Danish immigrants together to create an identifiable Danish community, it doesn't happen as often with Danes as it does with other European immigrant groups.
Now, again, this is something that happened with other cultures as well. But within the Danish-American community, there was a split between two different ways of thinking, particularly in the Danish church. And you have and others have given this dichotomy, this schism, a fun nickname, which is the difference between the Happy Danes and the Holy Danes. Explain that to me.
Right. Yeah, the Happy Danes and Holy Danes. Those are labels that kind of later historians have come up with. And like most labels, they resonate and they stick because there is some truth to it. But of course, it's a little simplistic just to say these are the Happy Danes and those are the Holy Danes. The Holy Danes are not unhappy and the Happy Danes are not unholy. But it stems from kind of a different view and approach to the intersection between Christian faith and specifically the Lutheran faith and the broader practice of cultural heritage. Denmark is a national Lutheran country. It has a state-supported Lutheran church. And so most of the Danish immigrants would have grown up within that Lutheran context. Now, a lot of Danish immigrants come to the United States and say, hey, we don't have to stick with the Lutheran church anymore. And so they explore either other denominations or they choose to not be church participants at all.
Well, and the way so many individuals came, I'm sure it was really easy to assimilate into other cultures that were already part of the communities that they went to.
Exactly. And so some Danish immigrants had already been converted to the Mormon church, even in Denmark. And so they came as part of the Mormon migration. There were Danish Baptists who came over. But the dominant culture in Denmark was the state Lutheran church. And within that state Lutheran church in Denmark, you have, of course, a wide spectrum of kind of nuances of theology and practice. And what happens when you lose that kind of state system and now you're trying to practice this Danish Lutheran tradition in a whole new environment of the United States is that differences of opinions get accelerated and kind of emphasized. And so you have the kind of fall into two camps. And one camp are the followers of a Danish theologian and writer and thinker and politician. And his name, and it's a mouthful, Nikolai Frederik Severin Grundtvig, which is why we usually just use his first initials, NFS Grundtvig. And he was really a dominant influence in the shaping of Danish culture and what it would mean to be Danish in the second half of the 19th century. He embraced a really kind of holistic, I think we would call it today, a holistic approach to Danish faith and culture and community. And he argued that those things really couldn't be and shouldn't be separated, that it is just as important to maintain a sense of cultural heritage through folk dancing, through Norse mythology, through the songs and stories that are part of Danish culture, as it is to maintain the Lutheran church tradition within the churches and congregations. He was really the influence behind the creation of folk schools, which started in Denmark and spread through Scandinavia. And that's a really interesting educational model where usually for young adults, there are no grades, there are no exams, there's no diploma or certificate at the end. It is basically education for the sake of education. And it would be a mix of practical curriculum as well as cultural curriculum. And the whole idea was that people come together and experience education together. And in the interchange between your colleagues and peers, you learn both the cultural background of your heritage as well as you learn how to have a voice and to express yourself. And Grundtvig felt that this cultural background and educational value was really important for the vast majority of Danish citizens who would not go to university. But an educated population would be a more engaged population, more active citizens, and therefore to the benefit of the country.
So the folk schools, were they the kinds of schools where someone would go daily, or is this something you would do in your spare time? Was this kind of a hobby?
It was more like spending maybe a season or even a full year in residence, because a really important part of this folk school was being part of a community, that learning could not be done just in isolation, but that you do learn from one another as well as from instructors or other generations. So they were residential schools and still are. Some of these folk schools still continue along this model. Today, it might be something that a young adult does in a gap year between finishing kind of the public, what we would say is but public high school, and before going to university. It's an opportunity to explore different activities, hobbies, arts, crafts, and so they are residential schools.
It sounds like such a revolutionary idea for the time that it came about, because I guess when I think about people in the 19th century, I think about, you know, people maybe getting educated through grade school and then starting to make a living or helping their family make a living. That sounds luxurious, to take time to just learn.
It is, and it really was a very progressive idea and very influential even into the 20th century. You see people from the United States visiting these folk schools and being inspired to start similar things here in the U.S. And the folk schools would, you know, could be accommodating to the seasonal work of, you know, so often men would attend a folk school between November and March, you know, but when the harvest is in, you go to folk school for a few months, and then by the time it's time to start plowing and planting, you're back home in the fields. And so, you know, they did have to accommodate the realities of agricultural life, too.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Tova Brandt. She is curator of Danish-American culture at the Danish-American Museum in Elkhorn, Iowa. And she's busy preparing for Yule Fest Friday and Saturday at the Danish-American Museum, but also throughout the communities of Elkhorn and Kimmelton. She's also getting ready to open the new exhibit, Happy Danes on the Plains. It will be on display through April 10th. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are talking about Danish-American culture. Tova Brandt is the curator of Danish-American culture at the Danish-American Museum in Elkhorn, Iowa. They're preparing for their big Yule Fest, their holiday celebration on Friday and Saturday. And we are talking about the Danes who came to Iowa and how Danish culture has persisted in Iowa and around the United States. If Danish culture is part of your family tradition, you're welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And just before the break, we were talking about this dichotomy of Happy Danes versus Holy Danes. And you were telling us about the followers of N.F.S. Grundtvig, a Danish theologian who really incorporated the celebration of culture into religion and religion into community as well. We were talking about the folk schools, which were part of his tradition. So these folk schools, were they everywhere in Denmark, or were they, was there some controversy about them there?
Well, they started in the 1840s in Denmark. And that was when the first folk school opens, and they slowly spread throughout the country. Denmark had a huge national crisis. Well, a war. they had a war with Germany in 1864, and they came out the loser of that, and in fact, they lost a third of their territory through that war. And this became a really national identity crisis, as well as the very specific losses of territory and population. Denmark had to reframe for itself and its people what it meant to be Danish, because a couple centuries earlier, Denmark had been a multinational empire, and now it was very, very diminished. So this folk school model really offered a way for Denmark to to construct a new Danish identity through these values of culture and heritage. And that really sets the stage for kind of how Denmark defines Danishness today. So it was kind of thanks to Grundtvig's idea and the pioneering of this model that was kind of in place early enough to then kind of ramp up and teach new generations of Danish people kind of what it meant to be part of this Danish culture.
All right. So these are the happy Danes. And when they come to the United States and they form a community, and I realize we talked earlier about how many of the Danes that came over weren't part of Danish towns, but just were sort of assimilated into other communities. But there were some Danish towns. Elkhorn and Kimbolton are two of them. So when the happy Danes formed a community, things went a little differently from one of the holy Danes communities. What were the priorities in a so-called happy Dane community?
Well, in a happy Dane community, of course, the church is a central institution, just as in a holy Dane community, because the church represents kind of the difference between those. And just as an aside, the holy Danes are part of the what's called the inner mission wing of the Danish Lutheran Church. And they were more focused on inner piety, more fundamentalism, and a little more emphasis on biblical authority. And they really frowned upon dancing, drinking, card playing, things that would be temptations or distractions away from a more focus on your own personal faith. So the difference between the communities that these two groups create, the happy Danes would organize a community and sometimes very intentionally as a colony, and they called them colonies. They would create a community with a critical mass of Danes. And the first thing they build as a community is actually the community hall or gymnastics hall. They don't build a church right off. They build a gathering place that can serve a variety of functions, and that can be for community festivals, gatherings, celebrations. They can teach gymnastics classes there. They can teach folk dancing there, and they can also have their church services there. It's not until a few years later when the community is more well established and they have kind of the financial means to build a church structure that really they can be proud of, that they would build the actual architectural church. And the reason that is often given, why do you build a gym hall before the church? Well, you can have church services in a gym hall, but you can't do gymnastics in a church.
All right. So different priorities as the community is founded. And let's talk a little bit more about the Holy Danes, the so-called Holy Danes, because their tradition went beyond just not believing in dancing, playing cards and drinking alcohol. But something that is unusual for such a pious community, they actually adopted the English language in their church services before the happy Danes, the so-called happy Danes did. Why is that?
Yes, it is. It is interesting because we usually think that the more conservative group will want to stay as unchanged as possible. But for them, it was more important to be able to communicate the word of God in the most widely understood language. And since they were in the United States now, that language would be English. So they transitioned to English language services before the Happy Danes did, because for the Happy Danes, they were really trying to find a way to be Danish in America. They were fully American citizens and they were fully participant in American civil society, but they wanted to maintain Danish culture and Danish cultural life as long as they could. They wanted to transmit that to their American-born children. And a big part of that was maintaining Danish language, because the language is tied in with the religious traditions and rituals. It's tied in with the song traditions. It's tied in with the story traditions. And to lose the language really puts up a barrier in fully experiencing Danish culture. So those kind of more politically progressive happy Danes tried to maintain the Danish language as long as they could.
Interesting. And so what was the result of that? I can imagine that the happy Danes, with maintaining their language and their culture, their children would also have spoken Danish and maintained that culture. I would think that with the Holy Danes, if you're not speaking Danish, your kids are going to speak English, and then they would really become more American faster.
Yes, and we see that kind of the reality kind of runs into the vision, even for the Happy Dane communities. Even today, you can speak to people who grew up in Happy Dane communities and said that, you know, their parents spoke Danish at home and they grew up speaking Danish. But then they went to public school, and that was conducted in English. And so kind of by the time the oldest child started going to school, that next generation really was much more oriented towards English. You can see a lot of there's stories of social groups or youth groups where, you know, the official meeting would be held in Danish, and then everybody goes outside and hangs out on the streets and starts talking in English. So, so there was probably a little more kind of true bilingual life in the Happy Dane communities than you might have seen in the Holy Dane communities in the same years, because there was much more of a conscious attempt to maintain the Danish language. But there was also they had to bow to the reality that, you know, not every family was maintaining just Danish language at home. And so, you know, if they were trying to keep the younger generation involved in things like summer Bible school, where they would also teach, you know, Bible study and history and religious classes, but also gymnastics and folk dancing and a wider song tradition, well, they were going to alienate some members of that next generation if they didn't, you know, fully embrace English in keeping people engaged.
So in Iowa, you mentioned a few of the Danish communities in Iowa. Which ones were Happy Dane communities and which ones were Holy Dane communities?
Well, closest to the museum, Elkhorn was a Holy Dane community, and Kimbleton was a Happy Dane community. They're only 3 miles apart from one another, but those churches, you know, definitely represented those different groups. Cedar Falls, Iowa, had both a Happy Dane and Holy Dane congregations, and in fact, the Happy Dane group started in a small, what would be now just a suburb of Cedar Falls, Fredsville, which was not named for a guy named Fred, but Fred is the Danish word for peace. Ringsted, Iowa, is another Happy Dane community. There were Holy Dane congregations in Harlan, Iowa, and Audubon. Atlantic, I think, had one of each. So sometimes different communities, small towns would be organized more kind of single around a single church choice. But in a larger town, you could have two Danish Lutheran churches that would represent the two different groups.
Did the Happy Danes and the Holy Danes get along?
I think in their day-to-day life, the business interactions, just, you know, the daily interaction of bringing your farm goods to town and selling them and buying groceries and going to school, yes, I think so. And there certainly, you know, those everybody had to work together just to be part of society. I think it's more in, you know, when your church membership became a very important part of who you were and an expression of your values, and that's, you know, certainly the case when we're talking about the late 19th and early 20th century, that's when you get into more personal relationships. I think it would have been pretty scandalous for, you know, around the year 1900, for someone from a Happy Dane church to want to marry someone from a Holy Dane church. That would have been seen as a real barrier. But move forward a couple generations, you know, after the Second World War, and those distinctions are really becoming erased as generations move on.
Well, and thinking about Elkhorn and Kimbolton being so close together, was there a lot of interchange between the two communities?
There was. From a very early time, they shared the same school system. Elementary schools were still in the individual communities, but by the 1930s, all high school was in Elkhorn, and so the Kimbolton kids would go into Elkhorn every day. So there was a lot of interchange between them.
I'm talking with Tofa Brandt. She is curator of Danish American culture at the Danish American Museum in Elkhorn. We're talking about Danish American culture this hour, and we'd love to hear from you if your family has a Danish background and you've kept some Danish traditions alive. We'd love to hear your story. Were you happy Danes or holy Danes? Let us know. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Virginia is on the line in Ames. Hi, Virginia.
Hi. I was very interested because I guess I'm from a happy Dane family because my grandparents were born up near Fredericksburg in near Cedar Falls.
All right.
And my grandmother, my bestimo.
Yeah.
We called her Besta. And we've carried on some of the Danish traditions in our family. I'm Besta to my grandchildren.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm.
And then we do the rice porridge at Christmas with the cinnamon sugar and butter and the ebel skewer. My kids love ebel skewer.
Yeah, who doesn't?
Yeah. I still have my Besta's ebel skewer pan.
And is that the pan you use?
Yes, I use it. Yes, mm-hmm. It's an old one with a ring that you have to set the ring on the stove, and then you put the pan on top of that mm-hmm. in order to cook it. So it's very black, very well used.
So, Virginia, when you were growing up, did you learn much about what it meant to be Danish? Were some of the things that we've talked about this hour, the culture, were they part of your family?
Some of them, not the idea of the happy Danes and the holy Danes. I had never heard that before, but my grandmother, well, she grew up in a large family of farm family, and she was one of the younger kids. And I know when she went to school and they asked her to do the alphabet, the report was that she started reciting it in Danish and they all laughed at her. So she swore that she was going to speak English, but she did know Danish. And she would, because I did have for a while a Danish pen pal, and she would translate between the two of us. We were very proud of our Danish heritage. And she went to the Bethlehem Lutheran Church up in Cedar Falls, which had the ship in the nave of the church. Mm-hmm. They had the ship hanging, mm-hmm. which is very Danish.
Hmm. Yes, it is.
So, and why is that very Danish, Tova?
Well, there's a lot of kind of potential explanations for it. You know, Denmark is a very maritime country, and so the idea of having an emblem of a church, an emblem of a ship, in the church where so many people would be tied to the sea through their occupations, there's that connection. Symbolically, a church often represents. Or the ship, excuse me, I keep saying that wrong. A ship often represents the church in the world, that everyone is together on this ship. Sometimes it can represent Noah's Ark. Every church in Denmark would have a ship hanging from within the nave of the church, and that's one of those traditions that did carry over into some Danish American churches as well.
Well, Virginia, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for sharing. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. And here's a question from Tanya in Perry. I found out just a few years ago that the border between Denmark and Germany moved over the years. We were talking about the Schleswig-Holstein War earlier. And she said that also explains the spelling of my father's last name ending in Sen and people looking at me oddly when I told him it was German. Can you tell me more about the border moving?
Sure. Yeah, that could be a whole nother hour-long conversation. But in brief, The Schleswig and Holstein for many centuries were both duchies ruled by the Danish king, but they were not considered part of the nation of Denmark. And in the 19th century, the rise of nationalism kind of leads a lot of Danish politicians to think that, you know, Denmark should be just a place of Danes. Now, Schleswig is north of Holstein, and Schleswig was predominantly Danish. There were some Germans there, but it was mostly settled by – inhabited by Danes. Holstein was mostly German, and so the politicians in Copenhagen were really saying, let's get rid of Holstein, and they fought two wars over it.
Wow. Well, we're going to have to leave it there and then pick up the story in just a moment. I'm talking with Tova Brandt this hour. She's curator of Danish-American culture at the Danish-American Museum in Elkhorn, Iowa. Their Yule Fest is coming up Friday and Saturday at the Danish-American Museum and also throughout the communities of Elkhorn and Kimbolton. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Danish-American culture and Danish-Iowan culture. With me is Tova Brandt, curator of Danish-American culture at the Danish-American Museum in Elkhorn, Iowa. And just before the break, we were talking about when the Schleswig-Holstein region of Denmark became part of Germany, and you were saying that the Schleswig part was more Danish and the Holstein region was more German. Mm-hmm. Then what happened?
Well, they had to fight a couple wars over it, and Denmark nominally won the first one between 1848 and 1851. That actually inspires a lot of Germans to immigrate to the United States. So a lot of German immigrants who settle in the Quad Cities are from the Schleswig-Holstein area. Then about 15 years later, 1864, war breaks out again. And this time Denmark kind of picked a fight with a much stronger Prussia. And so they lose that fight very decisively. That means that Schleswig and Holstein are now under German rule and become part of the unified Germany just a few years later. And all of the Danes who were living in Schleswig become German citizens. That means that they are subject to conscription into the German army. All of their sons are expected to serve. A lot of Danes get conscripted into the German army in the First World War, even though they don't necessarily believe in the German cause. And so it's not until the end of World War I that those Danish areas are allowed to have a public referendum on whether they want to stay with Germany or return to Denmark. One third of Schleswig, the top third, votes to return to Denmark. And so the border shifts again, just slightly south. And that's the border that Denmark has today.
I'm curious because, as Tanya mentioned, in her background, she thought she was German. It turns out that she's historically Danish. And I found out the same thing about my family not that long ago as well. Did some of the people who left after this war, when they came to the United States, did they become part of German communities here? Was their Danish culture sort of lost?
It really depends on the individual because, you know, the people coming from Schleswig and Holstein had come from really a multi-ethnic place, and where for centuries people of German culture and Danish culture and Frisian culture had lived next to each other, had intermarried. And so even within one family, you might have family members who feel more German or feel more Danish. And so it really becomes a question of you are what you feel you are. And the culture that you carry with you as an immigrant is the culture that you bring to the United States. And just as all immigrants do, you have to just choose what balance between your home culture and the new culture you're joining, what balance you're going to strike in your own life, your family life, and in your public life.
Very interesting. We have a number of people who want to join our conversation, and you can too. You can call 866-780-9100. Asta is on the line in Ankeny. Hello, Asta.
Hi.
Hi there. And you grew up in a Happy Dane community?
I did. First of all, I need to tell you, I'm so glad you have Tova on. We are so fortunate to have her. She's so knowledgeable and just a wonderful asset to the Museum of Danish America. So thank you for having her on.
Well, our pleasure.
I was born in Ringston. And so, which was a Happy Dane community, but when I was born in 1945. It puts me old. But in 1946, my dad, who was the pastor there, accepted a call to Asco, Minnesota, which is another Happy Dane community. And that was an intentional colony of Happy Danes that was established. But when he came there in 1946, they were only using Danish language in the church. And that was one of the latest, or the longest holdouts, I think, for the Danish language in the church. And apparently my dad told them that he was glad to come, he was glad to preach in Danish, but they had to have English services every Sunday because the community was English-speaking. And so that was the first, that there was an English spoken every Sunday in church in 1946. So that's pretty late in the in the whole scheme of things. So, and then I just wanted to mention, too, that there's some of us that still hang on to the values of that Danish Grundtvigian culture. And there are some remnants of folk schools throughout the United States, and some that are particularly just based on the Grundtvigian model. And so, like, every year I go to Tyler, Minnesota for a week where we experience storytelling and singing and devotions and the whole concept of that theological concept of human first than Christian, which is the idea of the idea that God loves all people, which is part of our Grundtvigian theology. And then I also went to a folk school in Denmark.
Oh, really?
50 years ago. But I didn't speak English very well. I was the last of three kids, and so my brother spoke Danish, my sister spoke quite a bit of Danish. By the time it got to me, it was, you know, tak for mig, which is thanks for the food, you know. So when I went to school in Denmark, I had a steep learning curve. So, but it was a wonderful experience, and that whole thing that you talked about with, you know, no grades, the whole emphasis on learning for the sake of learning, it was a marvelous experience for me. I went there after my sophomore year at Grandview University, it's called now.
Yeah. Well, Asta, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. And Tova, I want to ask you, since Asta brought it up, tell me about the remnants of the folk school tradition in America today. Are there folk schools that are still going strong?
Well, there are a few in different ways, and Asta is a wonderful representative for the kind of the last really strong and operating folk school, which is in Tyler, Minnesota. It's called Danabo Folk School, and they do attract people from all over the country to their summer and fall programs, where people of multiple generations come to enjoy, again, in residence. They stay there in the old dormitory. Enjoy eating together, singing, learning, and just participating in a wide variety of activities. It's a wonderful example of that real Danish folk school model that started, you know, well over a century ago in Tyler. So that's that Danish folk school model. There are other institutions that have taken those Grundtvigian values and that educational value in different ways. Many listeners may have participated in elder hostel programs. They're now called Rhodes Scholar. Well, that whole model was inspired by the founder's visit to Scandinavia and visiting folk schools and seeing that learning does not have to end, you know, when you turn 22, and that, you know, older generations have just as much to give and just as much to learn as other generations do. There are folk schools in a more traditional type. For example, folk art-based folk schools, North House in Grand Marais, Minnesota, the John C. Campbell Folk School in North Carolina. And in Tennessee, there's a really interesting example called the Highlander Folk School, which was founded in the 30s. And this picks up on the Grundtvigian idea that education for all classes, especially working classes, creates a more engaged population. Highlander Folk School was founded with the idea that the local kind of Tennessee blue-collar workers should and could be educated to be leaders and and advocate for their own rights and working conditions. The Highlander Folk School later becomes a center for civil rights education. A lot of civil rights leaders travel to Highlander to learn better on about how to organize protests, how to implement their advocacy efforts. So the Grundtvigian idea comes out in a lot of ways. Even just pick up the catalog to your local community college, and there are always a couple pages of classes that anyone can take. You can learn ballroom dancing or yoga or cooking or gardening, and this whole idea that anyone can have access to ongoing education, we see that even in our community colleges, and that stems back to these Grundtvigian ideals.
Well, and I recently attended the presentation that you did at the first history camp of Iowa, and you showed a picture from that folk school in Tennessee, and you mentioned it was important in the civil rights movement, but the picture you showed was of Martin Luther King Jr. at the folk school, and Rosa Parks was there as well.
That's right. It's this wonderful picture from 1955. Martin Luther King Jr., Pete Seeger, the folk singer, and Rosa Parks all there in the summer of 1955. And this is 6 months before the Montgomery bus boycott begins. So you can really kind of trace the ideas and inspirations between the leaders who would then make such a huge impact in society.
Let's get back to the phones. Marlon is on the line in Garrison. Hello, Marlon.
Hello there.
Hi, and you also grew up in a Happy Dane community.
Yes, I did, in Hampton, Iowa, a little town of Colder and Latimer, but Hampton was the county seat. And we had a Danish congregation out in the country, and our summer Bible schools included classes, but also gymnasium and folk dancing. And unfortunately, language, Danish language, was not something I picked up, because when my grandfather came from Denmark, and he came because he'd been conscripted in the war and decided he was not going to fight again, and so he and Grandma came to the United States, and he said, now we're in the United States, we speak English, not Danish. So the only time that we heard Grandma and Grandpa speak Danish was when they had something they didn't want us to understand.
A time-honored tradition of many immigrants, I'm sure. So when you were growing up, was it important to you that you were Danish, Marlon?
Yes, it was, because it was a community. And, of course, the young people in church, we were all agrarian, in an agrarian area, and so we knew each other, and we knew each other's families, and we socialized together. So a lot of that social activity revolved around the church. We had a whole community building at the church. We had a gymnasium up on the upper floor, and we would hold folk dances, and then they turned into square dances. But usually once a month, there was a dance at the community, at the gymnasium, and then there would be an Abel Skeever supper. Probably every other month we had an Abel Skeever supper to raise funds and so on, but that was always fun. In the middle of the summer, why we would have, at the end of Bible school, why we would, have a program to do the folk dances, and then there was always a big fireworks display and a homemade ice cream social. So it was always part of the tradition, to be social together.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us, Marlon. And we have another message. This was from Bill in Carlisle. He said, I grew up in Ringsted, Iowa. I define a true Dane if they, quote, bleed coffee, and I'm going to say things wrong, if know what Peppernur, Eberskimer, and Wienerbrot is.
Yeah.
He wants you to talk a little bit about Danish food traditions.
Well, Danish food, of course, like so many kind of aspects of culture, food is terribly important. And food usually kind of sticks with us through many more generations than the language does or other aspects of culture, because food is so fundamental, and it's what we learn at home. So the food traditions, and especially the foods that are associated with special events. And so as the last message described, Peppernur, and those are little cookies, the Danish pastries, which is Wienerbrød in Danish, these are special event foods, and so they're all wrapped in with the traditions of when families get together, when they celebrate special events like a Christmas or a wedding or a birthday, and so those feelings of community and family and connection, that is where you learn your culture, and that is where culture lives longest. And so it's in those foods. And those traditions might change a little bit. If a Danish visitor came from Denmark today, they would see us eat æbleskiver for breakfast and add some Danish sausage called medisterpølse, and they would be horrified, actually. That we continually horrify Danish visitors because these are Danish foods eaten in an American way. Æbleskiver, for listeners who might not be familiar with them, these are basically pancake dough cooked in a round pan, little cups in a pan, so that they turn out
like
to be
cake pops.
Yeah, exactly. They're spherical pancakes, and you eat them in Denmark. It's usually kind of a Christmas morning treat or a holiday treat, But here it becomes a symbol of Danish culture, and so just as the Norwegians might have their lutefisk and meatball suppers, the Danes in America will kind of organize their special events around æbleskiver as kind of the iconic Danish food.
Now, I mentioned earlier Julefest is coming up Friday and Saturday in Elkhorn and Kimbolton and at the Danish American Museum. How do you celebrate Julefest? What's special about it?
Well, there's a lot of things, and as is appropriate, it's kind of a blend of Danish traditions and American traditions. You'll see, craft fairs going on with a variety of things and handmade goods. But we focus on some of the handwork traditions and the cookie traditions. So come on down and have some cookies and some glögg, which is kind of the warmed spiced drink we make without wine for Julefest, but you can doctor it up at home if you want to. And throughout town, you'll see examples of Danish handcraft, Danish food traditions, and then on Saturday evening, the community has its annual Christmas concert. And so with the song traditions and music traditions, both of Denmark and the United States, followed by, in the church hall, of a lunch that's kind of what you call it after, even if it's late at night, it's called a lunch, and some dancing around the Christmas tree.
And the people can also learn more about the Happy Danes and the Holy Danes. Your Happy Danes on the Plains exhibit opens at the same time, right?
That's right. That exhibit will be opening on Friday and will stay up through early April. And we've added a special focus on Kimbolton as our nearest neighboring Happy Dane town.
Well, Tova Brandt, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
I learned a lot this hour, and I hope you enjoy Julefest.
Thank you.
Tova Brandt is curator of Danish American culture at the Danish American Museum in Elkhorn, Iowa, where they will be celebrating Julefest on Friday and Saturday. Talk of Iowa is produced by Claire Roth, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can follow us on Twitter at IPR Talk. You can follow me on Twitter at Charity Nebbe. You can like us on Facebook. And of course, you can email us anytime. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Have a happy Thanksgiving.